Welcome back to the Veterans Advocate. My guest today is David Doc Joslin of Remedy Alpine. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining me today. So I know that we are kind of in some of the same groups on Facebook, and I saw your name floating around, and I saw that you did something really cool with veterans in Alaska. So I wanted to have you on the show and just kind of talk about some of your work.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yep. So I want to always kind of start it off with kind of the backstory. So you were in the military, right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. What did you do in the military?
So I was a combat medic in the Army for just about 20 years.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
Yeah.
What years did you serve?
I joined in 1993, and I did 7 years in the reserves. And then in 2000, I transitioned to active duty. And I served on active duty from 2000 until January of 2013. And I was medically retired from injuries and sustained in Afghanistan. So,
okay. So you went active just in time for 9/11 then, huh?
I did, right before it. And it was, I tell you what, 9/11 was an interesting day to be on active duty.
Yeah, I bet. So it was probably, you know, locked down and everybody's up in arms and you can't even get on base and busing everybody in and all that stuff, huh?
Yeah, I was assigned as a medic at the trauma center at Brooke Army Medical Center on 9/11 in San Antonio. Our credentials and our IDs as trauma center staff, we were considered essential personnel. So we had ThreatCom Delta passes to get in and out of the security point. So I actually, I jumped off base and went and picked up some of my friends' kids and got them back on base and then went back to the trauma center because we were locked down. We weren't getting any more patients at that time. And so I kind of took advantage of it. You know, you get away with that in your dumb little E4 and ask for permission versus forgiveness.
Yeah. So. E4 mafia, right? That's pretty
right.
Cool. So you were in during, you know, all of Iraq and Afghanistan too. So being a medic, I'm sure you probably, you know, saw a little bit of that kind of stuff, huh?
Yeah. So I was in OIF-1. I was in 2nd Brigade, 1st Armored Division. We deployed out of Germany. So we were deployed almost 16 months. We were the first brigade that got that 15-month extension or the extension into 15 months. So in Iraq from 03 to 04. And then came back and did staff time and some other career moves. And then I went back to Afghanistan in 08 and 09.
Yep. Iraq and Afghanistan. So what was it like being a medic in Iraq and Afghanistan? I bet that was probably kind of hard, huh?
Yeah, it was. So in Iraq, I was assigned to a mechanized infantry battalion. And so I was out on the front line on patrol every day. And then in Afghanistan, I was a medical platoon sergeant in the cavalry squadron. So not outside the wire as much as I was before, but I did, I had a fair amount of the time outside the wire. And yeah, we were, there were two different wars. Iraq, we just kind of patrolled around the contact and waited for something to blow up. In Afghanistan, it was a lot more kinetic, more gun on gun fighting and actual, firefight engagements. So, but yeah, as a medic assigned infantry and cavalry units, I was a frontline care provider for U.S. and coalition soldiers at the point of injury. So watched quite a few friends die, watched a lot of people blow up, and tried to help as many as I could. So,
no, I appreciate that. I mean, you medics, you guys do a wonderful job. And, you know, I think it's kind of an underappreciated thing until, like, we really need you. So, you know, thank you for everything you've done.
Yeah. No, it was I tell people all the time, and, you know, that it's that it, from the civilian community, people are like, oh, thank you for your service. And a lot of guys don't know how to respond to that. And I'm like, yeah, it was a lot of fun. You're welcome. Cause, it was, I didn't enjoy the bad days, but the good days were definitely good. And, I felt my mission was important. I believed in, the units that I served in and, I'd do it again in a heartbeat if I given the chance.
So did you have to train some of the Iraqi and Afghanistani guys that were around too to do some medical stuff?
Yeah, I got tied into that a little bit in Iraq in 04. The ICDC, the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, we were training kind of some first responder level combat lifesaver stuff with them. And then in Afghanistan, There was a base down the road with guys that didn't exist, that didn't have names, that were trained by three-letter agencies. And I helped train their medics as part of the emerging or growing Afghan Special Forces. I trained their medics for a little while. So, yeah, it was that was an interesting component of training the healthcare or the trauma care side of it, to working through an interpreter and getting people that have really essentially no background or no calling. They were just kind of like, you seem smarter than everyone else, so we're going to let you carry an aid bag and needles and stuff. So
yeah, that was going to be my next question. You know, how well do you think those lessons really stuck? Were there anybody who really kind of stood out as like a natural, or can you be a natural, or is it all like intellectual?
It's not that I saw, I would give it more to the intellectual. It's not that people stood out or people were a natural. It was that there was one or two of them it was in Afghanistan, Iraq. It was just, nobody seemed to care. And it was the kind of the give a shit factor, right? In Afghanistan, there was one or two guys that really cared about the mission. It cared about what they were doing, and it meant something to them that they were selected to receive this additional training. The guys in Iraq, just, they were whatever. They didn't have a heart for it. Whereas the guys in Afghanistan that I trained, they seemed to be kind of vested in their purpose and mission. So that meant a lot more. And I think I probably trained harder with them, because, you know, I think you always commit more when you know that there's buy-in on the other side, right? Versus, you're not going to give it your heart and soul to guys that are going to dismiss it as soon as you walk away from them. So.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, you know, because you're trying to teach them a very valuable skill that might help them and other people. And I guess that you can't make them see the value in it, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
So you've been out of the military for probably going on close to 7 years now. So what was your motivation for getting into the military? You said you were medically retired, didn't you?
I was, yeah. Okay. So I was med boarded due to injuries that happened in Iraq, and then for PTSD from both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So that's pretty common. You know, I talk to a lot of guys who have a very similar story, you know, medical and mental things. And that's just one of the unforeseen things about military service. So when people say thank you for your service, there's probably a lot of things that go through our brains at that very instant, right? You know, and it's, what do I say? You know, do I talk about those kind of things? I don't know.
Right.
Thanks. Bye.
Yeah. You have no idea what you're truly thanking me for. So
there
is that, which is why, like I said a moment ago, I kind of coined a phrase as like, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. You know, cause I don't want to, you don't want to put the harsh reality or the negativity of things. And I think it's important for civilians to understand that we don't hate our jobs. For us, for the warriors that truly believed in and loved what we did, it was gratuitous for us. You know, if not, why the hell would we stick it out for 20 years?
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, and you don't ever really want to kind of squash their spirit, you know, because they love the military and they support the hell out of us and they're there for us. So yeah, you definitely want to keep that going.
Yeah.
So when you got out, then you're medically retired in 2013. So what have you been up to for that amount of years?
A lot, probably a lot more than I should have been. I had, at the time, my kids were in junior high and entering high school, and I had this need to, still provide support for my family. And luckily, after my first deployment in 03 and 04, I started studying healthcare administration. So I'm actually a senior operations director for a national healthcare firm. So I manage like 50 clinics in 6 states. But as cool as that sounds and as important as that sounds, it didn't serve all my purposes. It didn't fill all my needs. And one of the things that I was really missing after, it was probably about the first 6 months that I was out, was the belonging. The camaraderie, you know, especially being a remote operated healthcare executive where I'm never face to face with people. This is my daily interaction, is video calls and conference calls. And it, so I felt the missing of my tribe or the missing of my squad, my platoon, my element. And then, although I'm doing healthcare related things, and that's what I was in the military, the biggest thing that I loved about my job in the Army was I took care of the warfighter. I was doc. They came to me with their problems. They came to me with things. And nobody came to me with anything but a profit and loss statement issue now. And so there was a void in my life. There was this huge gap in my life that was created. And I started spiraling down paths that I probably shouldn't. I noticed I was drinking more than I should. And especially as a healthcare dude, you know, we're the worst patients ever. And we recognize when we're doing stuff wrong. Luckily, I listened, you know. And I've always been into mountain climbing. I've always been into hiking. And I might be segueing for you, just kind of the way the conversation's leading. But it's all part of the natural progression of me getting out of the Army. I was a mountaineer for the Army. I had my ECHO identifier. I went to Army Mountain Warfare School in Vermont. And so I've always been comfortable in the mountains. I've had formal training. And I noticed that I went to the mountains for peace. I started getting out away from cell phones, away from society, because it was peaceful out there. And that was a little bit of a transition too, because the first years I was in Alaska, while I was still on active duty, I couldn't stand to be in the mountains because it reminded me too much of Afghanistan. And I was always afraid the mountains were going to start shooting at me again. So it took me about a year to get comfortable back in being in the mountains again. And then once I found that comfort, that's where I went to kind of make things right in my head. And then along the way, I met who is now one of my business partners. And we started hiking together. We met through Wounded Warrior Project. And we started hiking together, and we realized that that's how we dealt and coped with a lot of our anxiety and our stress. And then it helped started building that camaraderie. So I started filling part of my void because now I had someone I could rely on and someone I could trust. But there was still a niche that wasn't being filled, and that was taking care of the warfighter. So Eric Collier, who's my business, one of my business partners, we were sitting around one day thinking, how can we do what we do? Cause we know it brings us some peace and solitude. How can we make that into a program to help other veterans? It was August of 2017. We were joking around and we kind of threw together a bullshit logo and we made an advertisement and threw it out there. And we had 9 veterans sign up for our first trip and only 2 actually completed the trip with us. And we did a 26-mile trek from Girdwood, Alaska, and Eagle River, Alaska, through this back range on a route called Crow Pass. And in that 2 weeks that we developed it until we executed it, the support from the local community, because we're right next to Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, so we're in a military community. The outpouring of support from the community and the number of veterans that were interested, hey, I can't make this one, but let me know when you're doing your next trip. When we came home from that first trip, we kind of hit the brakes. We're like, holy crap, we've actually got something here. So that when we started, that's when we went into a business building mode for the rest of 2017. And we officially formed our company, Remedy Alpine.
That's awesome. So how many veterans have you guys helped through hiking so far?
Last year, we took 49 veterans into the mountains. And then we connected with another 150 through outreach and community social programs. We do what we call Bullets to Beans the second and fourth Thursday of every month. So tomorrow night we'll be doing it again. And we just meet at a local coffee house. Sometimes we talk about our mountain climbing programs. Sometimes we talk about transition. Sometimes we talk about, you know, we all tell war stories from our deployments and we like fishing stories, right? There's, you know, we got shot at one time and all of a sudden now it's a 3-hour firefight that we were in. But it builds that community bond and allows veterans to sit down with other people that are seeking the same, either mutual support, camaraderie, anything to break down isolation to work against that anxiety and depression that builds in a lot of us. So we took 49 on the mountain in 2019. Our goal for this year is to triple that to get 150 veterans up in the mountains. So.
That's cool. Do you guys usually take the same course or do you guys sort of mix it up a little bit?
No, so we offer 4 different styles of programs in our programming, and we're So we do veterans recreation, and then we do therapeutic adventure are the two types of programs we do, because we do have a therapeutic value and a therapeutic intent in our delivery, but we don't have social workers or psychiatrists or mental health providers out in the mountain with us. We consult with some from time to time, but we're not governed by a licensed practitioner, which is why we don't advertise recreational therapy programs, because I don't have a therapist on staff. But we do single day hikes. We do single overnight camps or one-time camping events. And then we do multi-day, multi-night through treks, like the 26 and 30 mile, 2 to 3 day hikes that we do. And then we do basic mountaineering, where we will take, folks up the side of a mountain, crampon, ice axe use, kind of glacier travel, not really rope teamwork and the full technical component of mountaineering. We took in April last year, we took a team to Mount Hood and climbed Mount Hood in Oregon. And then this year in June, we're taking a team to Mount Rainier in Washington and climbing Mount Rainier.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like to hike too. Me and my buddies, we go on a hike every year, and we usually either go to Colorado, because we live in Kansas right now. So it's pretty convenient for us to just either drive out there or take a real short flight and, you know, just take like 2 days off and then have a weekend plus travel. And we'll go out to Colorado and do some trails. Some of them are kind of hard. Some of them we take a little easy depending on what we're feeling like. And we like to go to Washington a lot because for us, you know, we're at 1,200 feet elevation. So if we go to Washington, we can hike some really cool trails with trees and stuff, but not really have to deal with the elevation too much, because it's kind of hard to go from Kansas to Colorado in 8 hours and then hike 10, 11,000 feet. And that really kicks our ass. So we try to scale it back a little bit these days.
Well, yeah, and that I totally understand that the variables and the dynamic there. So in Alaska, even though we've got mountains all around us, my house is at 800 feet.
Oh, wow.
Because Anchorage is right on the water. And like when we went to Mount Hood in Oregon, you know, we fly in and then you drive up and you park at the Timberline Lodge, which is at like 5 feet. And when we climbed Mount Hood last year, we flew. We had two of our board members that are in Arizona, and they live at like 5,000 feet in Arizona on the desert plateaus. You know, we all met and did a team training event the very first day that we were in Oregon, and the team of us from Alaska, I mean, we left sea level, and, you know, 5 hours later, we're at 5,200 feet training on a mountain, sucking wind, I don't feel like the guy who's in charge right now, because I can't breathe. Yeah. And, you know, the Chugach Mountains, the mountain range where we're in Alaska, you know, most of our peaks are between 3,000 and 7,000 feet. So although it's pretty solid mountain climbing, it's not, we don't get into the great altitudes. You know, everyone knows Mount Denali up in the Alaska range is 20,323 feet or whatever it is. But that's, you know, 200 miles away from us. The mountains that we typically operate in, 4,000 or 5,000 feet. So,
oh yeah, that's not bad at all. That's totally manageable, especially if you're doing like an overnight, because that first night, you know, by that second time, the second morning when you wake up, you're usually feeling pretty good by that point.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you guys do any kind of like wilderness survival? Because if you're back there, let's just say like you get a guy from the city who's never really done something like that before. Do you guys do kind of like a crash course, or do you just go for it and then work it out?
No. So as a medic and as someone who I spent 2 years on Alaska Mountain Rescue Group on the state mountain rescue team. So I've got a search and rescue background also. Risk mitigation and risk planning is built in, safety is built into every component of what we do. We do an orientation at a minimum the night before we go out on the multi-day events. That way, you know, simple things like firing up a jet boil stove, guys that have never used the equipment before. We had a guy set one of the jet boil stoves on fire last summer because he was just tired and his mind wasn't working. We'd been hiking 12 hours that day and we crossed a river. And so he was just kind of mentally spent, and he fired the jet boil up without putting any water in it. Mm. He meant to start it and pour water in it. Then he got distracted by something. And he just burnt the koozie off the side of the jet boil. You know, so we get people that, although they're veterans, you know, we've all done different things in life. Not everybody was a forward element guy, you know, or girl. And so we do an orientation training to try to get people used to the equipment, understanding, you know, what a 30 degree rated sleeping bag actually means. And, you know, why you use, you know, wool or synthetics over cotton for their, you know, just kind of going over everything from basic layering of clothing to the use of how to fit your backpack right and how we set up camp and kind of the priorities at work at camp. And so, yeah, we do an orientation. So one of the other things too, we were really honored to be able to receive a grant last year to provide equipment. And that's one of the big things. Our goal is veterans, when they participate in our programs, they don't touch their wallet at all. If they don't have equipment, we outfit them. So we have a storage unit full of backpacks, sleeping bags, tents, trek poles. We've got everything for them. Because we, you know, mountain climbing and mountaineering, backcountry stuff, it's a cost intensive recreation.
Yeah.
And we don't want that to be a barrier to folks getting into the wilderness or into the natural spaces to try to recover and calm down a little bit. So we provide all the equipment. So we want them to know how to use the equipment, because I got to protect my investment a little bit.
Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah, it's kind of an expensive hobby, right? Because I saw a meme one time. It was something like camping is just wealthy white people pretending to be homeless or something like that.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah,
so. I got a pretty good laugh at that one, because you're right. That stuff's not cheap. You know, have an Osprey pack that was like $150, and a jet oil is like, you know, like $60. And if you want a nice sleeping bag, you can spend. You can spend $500 on a sleeping bag.
Easy. You know? Yeah, easy.
If you want a lightweight tent, you can, the sky's the limit, basically.
Oh, yeah.
What do you want to spend? And you got to kind of compromise between longevity and weight and price. And that's kind of where the fun part comes in, is kind of analyzing that. Okay, you know, I can get down to sub 25 pounds for this 2-day hike, which is, you know, not bad. And
no.
But I'm comfortable. I could get it down to 20 pounds. It would cost me another $500 to do it, but, you know, I mean, my feet would feel a lot better.
Yep. Yeah. And that, you know, and that's the one thing too, is we want to get, so we've got, for the most part, top of the line equipment. I want it to be comfortable. I want people to, you know, if they're miserable, if their pack just isn't fitted right, and they're, you know, 10 miles into a 30 mile hike and they just want to drop it and be done with it, then it's going to take away from the positive effect that we're trying to shoot for them. So, you know, we work closely with, like Osprey, the North Face, Black Diamond, most of the major, manufacturers, and we provide the quality equipment to get them comfortable on the mountain, so they'll enjoy the experience. And then we try to work with them too to help introduce them to those companies in a way that we can offset some of the price. We're allowed to get stuff at discounted rates and stuff with certain vendors. So if people continue to come back with us and they start getting to that point where, hey, I want to buy my own equipment, we will guide them in that purchase, and then we'll use our brand and our reputation to help offset the price for them a little bit. Because it sucks buying all the equipment. Ask my wife. I've got a garage that looks like REI that we can't even park cars in.
Yeah. Do you guys get into hammock camping at all, or do you kind of stick to tents because that's what people know and are comfortable with?
We stick to, for our programs, we stick to tents because that's what kind of some of the comfort. Plus, like in Labor Day weekend this last year, once you get into the alpine space, above the tree line, you can't hammock camp.
Yeah.
And some of our trips go into alpine and then down into the taiga or tundra or the tree line and then up over again. So we kind of, because our goal is to get above the tree line and get into the alpine space, tents are the logical option. Now, I've personally hammock camped a couple of times when I lived up in northern Alaska or central Alaska in Fairbanks. My rock climbing partner and I, we would go out on Friday night and hike into where we were rock climbing the next day, and we would hammock camp at the base of the rock face where we planned on climbing, And so when we woke up in the morning, we were right there ready to rope up and get after it. So, and I found that to be pretty enjoyable. You can shed tons of weight. Mm-hmm. It's an alternative that, one of our guides, he hammock camps a lot, on his own, and he keeps pushing that button with us. He's like, "Hey, we should really try to do this." I'm like, "Yeah, we can't do that above the trees though."
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's something that it's a discussion point that comes up with us from time to time. We just haven't, our programming hasn't really allowed it just yet. So, but we're growing. So you never know. Next time I talk to you, I could say, "Yeah, I just bought 50 hammocks."
Nice. Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah. Where I live in Kansas, it's tents half the time, and then it's hammocks the other half. So in the summer, you have to have a hammock because the bugs are just so damn bad that you wake up and there's just spiders covering all over your tent, and it's just gross. I mean, they're outside, but still, I mean, it's just not really fun. So if you're in a hammock, you can avoid a whole lot of that. But in the wintertime, it's so windy that you really need to be in a tent on the ground. I've never had like a... They have bibbies that go over your hammock, you know, like I've never tried one because they're really expensive and I'm kind of leery to spend, you know, $200 on something like that. And I always wondered, you ever tried something like that?
I haven't. I've seen them. I've been in just a bibby sack, but not in a hammock. I've seen them. I've heard good things about them. And again, I think that's kind of a preference thing too. The guys that really like to hammock camp, and want to get after it in some questionable weather, mm-hmm. You know, that gives them, you know, a little bit more sunshade protection and some rain and moisture protection as well. I'm curious about it. I haven't done it personally though.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much cool stuff out there. I mean, you can just spend all day researching it, the brands and getting down in the nerdy stuff with, you know, like the weight and the special materials that they're made out of, and get cumin fiber stuff, which is just ridiculously light.
Yeah, a buddy of mine that does an ultralight hiker in I was over at his house one day, and he was stripping the zipper pulls off of all of his equipment. I'm like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I can cut like 7 grams out of my pack if I get rid of the zipper pulls." And I'm like, "Dude, we are on totally different spectrums. If you're counting grams in your backpack, I weigh my pack before every event and every mission, just to as a guide and as the team medic, and we've got radios and I've usually got a satellite phone, and especially if it's a multi-day event, I typically go out with about a 40 to 45 pound pack. Oh, wow. So I try to know, okay, if I'm sub 45 pounds, I'm good. If I'm right at 45, okay, let's rethink this. What do I need to pull out? And did I overthink my med kit? Did I overthink certain things that are all, you know, tell one of the other guides, I was like, "Hey, you got to take the sat phone. I'm not taking it today." But yeah, I don't get to grams. I look at solid pounds, right? You know, and part of it too, you know, your kit that you've got to take out with you if you're in charge is, you know, you're not going to be as fast as light as everybody else. So,
yeah. No, that's interesting. I take a very minimal first aid kit. So I'm curious, talking to you, you know, you've got some experience in that, obviously. So like, if I wanted to have a first aid kit to just have around for just general purpose, you know, what would be some good things to put in that?
I would go with, what is it? The Mountain Medics. They do, I can't remember their name now. They do perfect prefabricated first aid kits. You know, bleeding control, but some of it's the reality of what you're doing and where you're at, you know, just, gauze and some ACE wraps. You can build a pressure dressing with just some roller gauze and an ACE wrap. If you do get any kind of a significant bleeding problem, but bandages, triple antibiotic ointment like Neosporin, stuff like that. You know, and some basic, you know, pharmaceutical stuff like Tylenol, ibuprofen, Benadryl. They're leaning away from Benadryl more now because some recent studies are showing that it has more permanent or lasting negative impact to the brain. So a first line antihistamine, more like Zyrtec. But yeah, you know, so one of the things that we do with Remedy Alpine is every before we go on a multi-day event or even a single-day event, I do a medical screening, and that's I still play doc. And then, you know, because we're taking a lot of wounded vets out. So if I know somebody's got a history of, you know, multiple ankle sprains or rolling your ankle or knee problems, I pack my kit specifically for the people that I have on the trail with me to try to mitigate some of their stuff and figure out what the likely medical probability would be that I'd have to work on. And we tailor the kit specifically to each mission. So.
No, that's a pretty good idea. You know, you're not really expecting, you know, like a combat scenario. So it's, you know, there's probably some things you could probably leave out and some things maybe you should take for like a sprained ankle. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So I always like to kind of wrap up the show by asking just a few basic questions. So I know you were in the Army for 20 years as a medic, and then now you do what you do now, but what was it like when you first got out of the military? I know that you said that it was kind of hard and it kind of struggled. So I want to kind of just ask that question and then follow up with what advice would you give somebody who's looking to get out soon?
Good questions. And so the first part of that, when I first got out, I think military transition, it's, I define it as a slide rule. Some days I'm more of a civilian, some days I'm more of a soldier. And if I could just give my own podcast a shameless plug, because I'm talking about these two questions that you're asking me right now in the next week's episode of Bullets to Beans. So this will be a good preview for folks.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I got out, there was this honeymoon period, right? It's cool. I can wear what I want. I don't get yelled at. I can sleep in. I don't have all this organization and structure over me. And then in about 60 days, I missed the organization and structure. You know, I missed getting up and doing PT. I found that I really, you miss certain things. The camaraderie is the biggest part of it. Nobody appreciates getting yelled at. I was a sergeant first class as E7 when I retired. So, you know, it's not like I was getting yelled at often, right? But I had structure. And then I got into a place where, you know, the military is simple life. They tell you where to be, how to dress, what to do, and how to act when you get there. And then I found I was running into decision fatigue. You know, I'd come home and my wife's like, what are we going for dinner? I'm like, I made 50 decisions before I left the house today. I don't want to make another decision. You know, I had to, you know, there were days my wife would make fun of me because, you know, I'm standing in front of my closet for like 20 minutes. She's like, are you getting dressed? I'm like, I don't know what to wear. You know? So there was a kind of a honeymoon period where it was cool. And then there was kind of a fall where, hey, this is reality. It's not just being on leave. This is permanently how life is going to be now. I can't go back, I can't go back to duty. And then I started getting into some of the challenges with some of the recurring anniversaries of attacks or deployments or friends dying or whatever. And I really struggled in missing the military structure, missing my brotherhood. And then you come out of it, you had to kind of fight through understanding the problem a little bit and knowing that unlike the military, I am in control of my fate. I am in control of my destiny. So, and there's that can be empowering or it can be defeating. It's figuring out what switch you have to flip to make it empowering. And then kind of lead into the second half of that question about advice or what I'd tell people getting ready to get out. And there's kind of two phases or there's two different buckets on that one. You know, I was medically retired. I didn't choose when I got out of the military. They were like, you're broken. You're not a shiny spoon. You're done. And within 9 months, I went through the whole evaluation process to wearing jeans and a t-shirt every day again going, well, okay, I hung my uniform up. Whereas the guys that are actually retiring, that they plan it out a little bit more. They have, I think, a little bit more control over it. But I would say be prepared. You know, kind of the whole Boy Scout motto, be prepared. It could happen whether you're planning to retire in 10 years or not. Always be thinking about your exit strategy and not that you should have your foot halfway out the door, But the Army will love you. The government will love you when you're in, and they will do what they're required to do for you when you're out. That it's not a mutual relationship. And that's not a bad take on the military, and that's not to discredit the service, but that's just the reality of it. And people need to wrap their head around reality. Go to ACAP or Soldier for Life or your transition training program for whatever your service is. And that is like everything else in the military. You get out of it what you put into it. You know, I would see a lot of soldiers when I was going through ACAP back in, when I was retiring 7 years ago, it was still ACAP, you know, that were showing up because they got to wear civilian clothes all day, but they weren't taking anything serious. You know, take advantage of every class you can. If there's somebody who says, hey, we'll do mock interviews for you if you want, go do mock interviews. You know, have somebody sit down with you and convert your resume to a civilian resume. Nobody on the outside knows what a freaking NCIC is. We all know what it is, right? But no, if you're at a company level, that's a manager. You're for battalion or brigade level, that's a director. Know how to change the roles and responsibility titles to where it's synonymous with civilian language. You know, and then be open-minded. Civilians are different than we are. Yeah, I've been a veteran for 7 years now, and I still can't mesh with the civilian community. Is, you know, even though I've got an executive level job with a national firm, I have people that dial into phone calls because they see that I'm on the invite list just because they know I'll say the weirdest shit. and they're just like, no, we're just here to hear Dave talk. Cause we are different. And then the other thing that I would say to close is be proud of what we did as a service and be proud of your service. I was specifically hired I didn't even apply for my job. I was specifically hired because of my LinkedIn profile, and my company values veterans and military leadership. And they, you know, they could find a healthcare administrator. That wasn't the problem. They wanted a healthcare administrator who could work alone, manage big complex problems in a diverse landscape from, you know, I've got businesses in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Colorado. They want someone who can work unsupervised in that capacity. And as they were building out their made for military leadership was the number one quality they wanted over healthcare management experience. Healthcare management experience was there, but they wanted a military leader because they at least understood the value of what a non-commissioned officer or a senior non-commissioned officer or a company or field grade officer from the military can provide them. So be proud of what you did and figure out how to sell yourself. And then, you know, and be open-minded because you're gonna hear some stuff that's just gonna blow your mind, and it'll frustrate you. And the final piece is don't choke anybody, because you'll want to.
maybe we move that one up front just to right. Get that out of the way.
Yeah, that shouldn't be a postscript. Yeah, that should be up there. But yeah, and keep all the people that frustrate you, keep in mind those are the citizens that you swore to protect. The diversity of our country, whether we like politics, whether we like what's happening across the country right now or not in our political system and everything, we swore to die for that. So just at the end of the day, remember, you're one of the top 2%, top 1% of every living person in this nation. Be proud of that and continue to soldier on and represent your service as well. Because if you get a good job and any job, and they hired you knowing that you were a veteran and that was part of the selection criteria, you're now an ambassador for every veteran who looks for a job.
Absolutely.
So.
Yep, they're gonna look to you to set the standard for everybody that comes after you. Yep. And if you screw it up, they're not gonna hire veterans anymore. So.
Yeah.
No, that's a good point. I didn't ever really think of it that way, but you made an excellent point. So if people want to find out about you personally and your podcast and Remedy Alpine, what's the best way to do that?
So probably the first way would be to our website, which is www.remedyalpine.org. We're on Facebook at Remedy Alpine. We're on Instagram at Remedy_Alpine. And then the podcast has its own subpage on our website, and then it has its own Facebook page at Bullets to Beans. So we just launched our first episode this week. So we had a pilot episode as well. So this week's episode was on veteran suicide and a discussion around that. We're on, since we're still in the launch process, I think Stitcher, Spotify, and TuneIn, it's already released on. We're waiting on the release approval from Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Apple. Apple takes the longest to get something for your initial release out. So we will be on those six podcast channels or offerings. We're just we're still so new to it that we're in the approval process. So
yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to hearing that, you know, and if you ever need a guest, I'm happy to come on.
Oh, I've already got you written down on my board of people to bring on. So I appreciate that.
All right. Well, hey, I want to thank you so much. It's been awesome. You know, I love talking about hiking, and I might be hitting you up for some advice on some gear for our next one.
Yeah,
I think we're heading out to Everett, Washington for a hike out in that area. So yeah, I might lean on you for some gear advice.
No worries. Yeah.
All right. Well, hey man, you take care.
Hey, you too. Have a great day. I appreciate the discussion.
Yep. Talk to you later. Bye.
Goodbye.